From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to the Monday edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for FRC Action, and it's my pleasure to be sitting in for Tony today. Well, Congress may be in recess, but the rest of the world keeps on moving, and we have plenty of material to cover today. Whitworth University is going to kick us off. A private Christian university in Spokane, Washington, voted not to allow conservative commentator Ben Shapiro to speak on campus through Young America's Foundation Fred Allen Lecture Series. I'll be talking with Nicole Neely, who is the president of Speech First, and we'll be addressing why this happened. In my second segment, the Chicago-based U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit unanimously rejected an atheist group's challenge to end the parsonage allowance, a federal tax provision that allows churches, mosques, and synagogues to provide faith leaders with a tax-free housing allowance. Luke Goodrich, vice president and senior counsel at the Beckett Fund, who represented a leader of a Southside congregation in this suit, will join me to discuss. At the bottom of the hour, New York Times best-selling author Joel Rosenberg will join me to talk about his latest international thriller entitled The Persian Gamble, about a terrifying nuclear alliance among three world superpowers, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, and the man who must halt their deadly strategy. Finally, at 42 past the hour, we will talk about a drag queen story hour in which a convicted sex offender made it through the front lines and read to Houston Public Library children. Kirstie Cross of Louisiana Family Forum will join me, and I will talk in the second portion of that segment with Jennifer Bryson, who contends that the International Soccer Association should not mandate that professional soccer players be forced to wear athletic jerseys that promote and endorse the LGBT agenda. As a reminder, you can visit the podcast for the show at tonyperkins.com and follow Tony on Twitter at tperkins. You can follow me as well at Sarah P. Perry. And as always, for more information, you can click through, and we encourage you to share the podcast with your listening friends. At the Conservative Political Action Conference recently, President Trump announced that he was planning to issue an executive order affirming the free speech rights on college campuses in the near future and protecting free speech if colleges wanted to receive their cut of $26 billion in federal funding for research. Let's listen to what President Trump had to say.
Today, I'm proud to announce that I will be very soon signing an executive order requiring colleges and universities to support free speech if they want federal research dollars.
Obviously met with raucous cheers, this comes in the wake of increased discrimination against conservative activists from coast to coast at universities both conservative and liberal. And the most recent example was a vote Wednesday evening where the Associated Students of Whitworth University, a private Christian university in Spokane, voted not to allow conservative commentator Ben Shapiro to speak on campus through the Young America's Foundation Fred Allen Lecture Series. The result was a reportedly unprecedented 8-8 tie, which was broken by the student body president to deny Shapiro's appearance overall. So here to put this story into perspective is Nicole Neely, president of Speech First. Nikki, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, you and I share a passion in this area. Education is something about which I'm very passionate, as I have three children in public schools currently coming up the ranks and have just finished registering for high school classes. So college is not too terribly far off for us. So I have to ask you, are you surprised by the decision from the student government to block a conservative talk show host, particularly at a conservative college?
You know what? I actually, sadly enough, am not surprised by this because we've seen on college campuses, public, private, Christian, non-Christian, that there just is this tremendous culture pressure on students to conform. I mean, to silence themselves. If you're a conservative, most students I mean, looking at polls by the Gallup Foundation, by the Knight Foundation, by the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, students are terrified to express their opinions on campus. A recent poll last year from the University of Texas found that 80% of students say that they have prevented themselves, they've self-censored, out of fear of offending someone. And so, sadly, you know, we see Christian discourse more often than not being considered hateful by students on campus today. So it's disappointing, but it doesn't surprise me.
Well, and we've seen it on campuses that are even as liberal and are the cradle of the free speech movement in America. For example, UC Berkeley. We've seen activists in an area in which we might ordinarily have said, well, at least here where they understand the virtue of free speech and how intellectual discourse leads to the development of academic prowess and intellectualism, they're still being shut down. So we can't seem to win on conservative campuses or extremely liberal campuses, which is, I think, discouraging for some of the people who are in this field. So
absolutely.
We know that...
Oh, sorry. You mentioned that you have a child going to high school. I mean, I think it is almost dereliction of duty for parents to not research how some of these issues are treated on campus as their children go off to college. It's more than just tuition, but it is definitely how civil rights are treated on campus these days.
Well, so we know Whitworth President Beck Taylor, who was sort of the acting tiebreaker in this particular situation, tried to sort of quell the rising discontent and disappointment and said that club speaker approval is a student government responsibility. So I've seen this verbiage, and I believe others have as well, that there's an offloading of responsibility by college administrators onto the student body themselves. And so by doing so, they have negated whatever portion they may have actually held originally in determining whether or not this is an opportunity for all ideas to be heard, and instead have relegated these students to the creation and maintenance of their own safe spaces. So how do we overcome the fact that the student government has essentially become the president's office of these universities?
Right. No, I found those. I thought they were weasel words. I thought it was really inappropriate because, you know, at that point, it's the inmates running the asylum. How many 18-year-olds are fully formed human beings, right? I mean, there is a reason that we have college administrators. And they really should be setting the tone from the top because I think a lot of that behavior on campus flows from that. I mean, look at schools like the University of Chicago that, I guess it must have been 3 or 4 years ago, released what is now known as the Chicago Statement. It said, you are not here to be safe. You are not here to be comfortable. You are here to be challenged. You are here to grow. And I think, you know, that attitude then gets transmitted to other college, you know, administrators, to middle managers, to faculty. But if you have a president that kind of, you know, takes a back seat and says, all right, guys, it's up to you. I mean, we know how students are. And the fact that the president then cites the difficulty between balancing intellectual openness and safe and inclusive spaces, I think is really disingenuous because that's a false choice. And it really, I think, does a disservice to the history of the First Amendment and how it has been historically used to protect and get out the message of disenfranchisers from suffragists to abolitionists to civil rights activists.
Truly, the notion of a free America was founded on what were once unpopular ideals, right? So if we don't have the opportunity in that cradle of development where you send these 18-year-olds out to determine how they see and view the world and in which they can question all of the ideals that they know beforehand, then what we're doing is we're sending out into the world these individuals who are, like you referred to, sort of not entirely formed. So I think the consequences for that we see, for example, in the workplace. You know, there's sort of that now rising idea, the concept of millennials in the workplace not having a true understanding of what responsibility looks like or what they ought to be able to withstand. And sort of, you know, these gelatinous self-esteems are so easily wounded when, for example, someone like President Taylor offloads responsibility. And he said that this was a very difficult decision, and he was weighing the value of intellectual openness and the value of creating a safe and inclusive space for learning. But do you think that's a balance between safe and inclusive that we ought to be striking in the first place? Is it okay for colleges to be deemed intellectually dangerous?
No, I think that's horrible. I mean, I would just school not that long ago, and I remember how it was so exciting to go to school and realize this is a transition to adulthood, right? It's where you get to learn how to cope with others. You're free from the yoke of your parents. You get to make your own decisions, stay up until 2 a.m., eat dessert first, and then deal with the consequences of those decisions, right? Gain the freshman 15, do badly in a test. But that's up to you, and then you start to learn responsibility. But if students are protected from consequences, if students are not forced to, you know, deal with the realization and the fallout from their decisions, what kind of world are they going to go into? The world is not always a kind place. The workforce is not always going to take their side. I don't want to hire people like that. I don't want my children to become people like that. You know, I think we need students to be a little bit more resilient. And I think, you know, something else that's lost here is how fundamentally disrespectful the student government decision is, because they have denied the rights of their fellow classmates to make up their own mind for themselves about what Ben Shapiro says, and to feel that their fellow students either are too soft or would be wounded or maybe would be brainwashed by him. I mean, that to me is just mind-boggling that students would let their peers get away with making those decisions for them.
I would absolutely agree with you, and I think it's very pointed, very interesting, that when Trump made the pronouncement at CPAC this year, he did so alongside Hayden Williams, who is a field rep for the Leadership Institute, who was physically assaulted last month at UC Berkeley. So we've actually created the antithesis of a safe space, but only if your ideas happen to be conservative. Liberal ideas, we know, flourish as a matter of course on college campuses anyway. We understand that trend in academia moves to the left and not to the right. So they've actually used their own logic about safe spaces only to assure themselves that the space is safe for progressivism alone.
Right. I mean, the window of acceptable discourse is so narrow on college campuses, and it keeps shifting left and left and left. And students realize that there are consequences to that. There are the scene, I mean, Hayden Williams getting assaulted. There are the disciplinary actions that some students face through programs like bias response teams, where you can be anonymously reported by your fellow classmates for saying something that somebody deems offensive. But just as much what scares me is the unseen, that students are terrified of expressing opinions because they don't know what they'll be in trouble for. Administrators have accorded themselves these broad discretionary powers to determine, well, your words are hurtful. Your words aren't inclusive. I mean, I frankly don't want some diversity officer saying what is or is not inclusive. I'd like my peers to make up their minds for themselves. And, I mean, you know, these students are 18, 19, 20. You know, they deserve better.
I wholeheartedly agree. For those of you who are listening, if you disagree with President Taylor's position in this situation, you are free to email him. I encourage you to do so, president@whitworth.edu, or call 509-777-4665. Nikki Neely has been my guest today. You are listening to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry sitting in. Coming up next, the Chicago-based U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit unanimously rejected an atheist group's challenge to end a tax credit for leaders of churches. We will, coming up next, be able to talk with one of the attorneys from Beckett Fund who represented the plaintiff in that case right after this.
Picture it. Majestic beauty all around you. Wildlife, deep blue waters, glacial mountains, lush forests. Can you imagine the majesty of creation at every turn? Discover Alaska with FRC. You'll enjoy every moment of this unforgettable experience. Juno, accessible only by sea and air. Ketchikan and its impressive collection of Native American totem poles. Glacier Bay, a breathtaking wonder. All this, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what Family Research Council is doing in our nation's capital. You'll hear directly from FRC President Tony Perkins, General Jerry Boykin, and Michelle Bachman. This is no ordinary vacation. You'll be vacationing with the FRC family and a lot of new friends. Be rejuvenated as we deepen our relationships with God and each other. Don't just get away. Get away with purpose on Family Research Council's Alaska Cruise, July 7th through 14th. Call 844-872-5155 to register today or visit us online at frc.org/Alaska.
In recent news, we've seen the left's disregard for life. They've gone beyond defending abortion to now defending infanticide. We've seen the push for legislation in New York, Vermont, and Virginia that would allow abortion even on a baby's birthday. And if an abortion fails, to withhold medical care from the baby born alive, causing him or her to die. This is infanticide. In the left's most recent act of disregard toward human life, we saw each Democratic senator running for president vote against a bill that would protect babies born alive. Help us end birthday abortion. On the day of a baby's birth, the first article placed on the baby is a thermal hat with blue and pink stripes. That's our hope for every baby. But there are no federal laws in place to protect all babies born alive from being killed outside the womb. To show your support for the life of all babies born alive, visit endbirthdayabortion.com. For a donation of $9, we'll deliver one baby hat on your behalf to U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to send a powerful reminder that babies should be welcomed with warmth.
The world on our horizon isn't like the days I knew. Gone are the days of writing with fresh ink on thick paper and the swift crack of a letter opener. Homemade meals now replaced by fancy robots trying to figure out how often I buy organic goji berries. I don't even know what a goji berry is. My church started offering free Wi-Fi and changed their name from First Baptist to Radiant Water Life something or other. They even started posting video sermons recorded on wood pallet backgrounds that sync directly to a Dropbox that I have yet to locate. Thankfully, there's a silver lining to all this newfangled technology. Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. Put down your quill and contact your legislators directly from your smartphone or tablet. Share legislative alerts with your contacts and connect with like-minded Christians about the latest current events. Read the Washington Update and listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. This thing's got it all, buddy boy. Keep your cool and help secure our future at frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry of FRC Action sitting in today for Tony Perkins. In 2016, the atheist group Freedom From Religion Foundation sued the IRS, demanding that it end the parsonage allowance and begin imposing almost $1 billion in new taxes per year on churches, synagogues, and mosques nationwide. So on Friday, after many an appeal and very involved pleadings, the Chicago-based U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit unanimously rejected the atheist challenge. Good news for all of us, ruling that the tax exemption is indeed constitutional. My next guest today is Luke Goodrich, Vice President and Senior Counsel at the Beckett Fund, who represented Pastor Chris Butler, a leader of a Southside Chicago congregation involved in the suit. Luke, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Happy to be here.
So let me set up a little bit of the backstory here. So the title of the lawsuit itself, Gaylor v. Knuchin, the atheist group Freedom From Religion, sued the IRS to end a parsonage allowance. And that parsonage allowance, a longstanding tax benefit, is a federal tax provision that allows houses of worship, churches, mosques, synagogues, to all provide faith leaders with tax-free housing to help them actually live and minister in the community in which their churches are located. And this is not a new benefit. This is one that's been quite long-standing. This is $1 billion in tax revenue given out to people who are involved in these houses of worship so that they can do their best work among their congregants. But we understand that in 2017, the district court ruled that this parsonage allowance was unconstitutional. So on what basis did they make that decision?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Sarah. This was an atheist attack on churches. The atheists were basically saying, hey, it's not fair for the IRS to refrain from taxing churches. We want the IRS to impose these taxes on ministers. And so the IRS, the atheists were able to get a court ruling saying the IRS had to impose almost $1 billion a year in new taxes on churches and ministers across the country.
So that's a pretty onerous burden, considering that these are not only nonprofit organizations, and we understand the nature of nonprofit organizations themselves, but also churches and nonprofits, religious nonprofits specifically, like this, dole out $1.5 million in social program services during the course of any given year, which is huge. So we have these churches, the ones that run the homeless shelters, the ones that run the food banks, now under threat of being strapped with $1 billion in additional tax liability. So how did you happen to get involved with Pastor Chris Butler?
Yeah, so the lawsuit was the atheists against the IRS. And they're trying to raise taxes on churches. And so we at the Beckett Fund said, wait a minute, there's somebody missing from this lawsuit here between the atheists and the IRS. What's missing is the churches. So the Beckett Fund, we represented Pastor Chris Butler, who's a pastor on the south side of Chicago and would be harmed by this lawsuit. And we said, hey, court, you need to hear from the pastors and the churches that are directly affected by this lawsuit. So the court let the Beckett Fund intervene on behalf of these pastors, and we made a number of arguments that ultimately carried the day. The first argument we made is that this sort of tax benefit, this tax exemption for housing allowances, it's not unique to ministers. There are actually hundreds of thousands of non-religious workers all across the country who can get tax-exempt housing for their jobs. Soldiers, diplomats, Peace Corps workers, nonprofit presidents, oil executives, and on the list goes. And so our lead argument in the Seventh Circuit on appeal is that that this tax exemption for ministers actually places ministers in the same position as hundreds of thousands of secular workers. And so this is not special treatment, this is equal treatment, and the court should uphold it.
When you received word of the Seventh Circuit affirmation of the constitutionality of this parsonage allowance, what did your client, Mr. Butler, have to say?
Oh, Chris was thrilled. This legal provision is vital to his ministry. He lives on the south side of Chicago. It's a high cost of living area, and ministers directly to the folks in that community who need him. It's a small church. They're not able to pay him a full salary. And so the housing allowance that he gets from the church is really what enables him to live near his congregation and serve. And so when the district court struck that down, Chris was going to be directly harmed. And the ruling really protected him and his church and his ministry. And most importantly, it really benefits the needy people that his church serves.
Now, we always like to receive good news, and it's a surprise, I think, to many of us when some of the federal courts of appeal rule the right way. And this should have been, I think, a slam dunk from the outset. But knowing what we know about the state of jurisprudence and also of politics, do you anticipate that the Freedom From Religion Foundation will appeal?
I think they probably will appeal. I wouldn't be at all surprised if they do. They can appeal either to the full Seventh Circuit and ask for more judges from the Seventh Circuit to hear the case, or they can appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. But I'm not troubled by that prospect at all. At the Beckett Fund, we've won almost 90% of our cases. We're undefeated at the U.S. Supreme Court, and I'd actually welcome a chance to make the case at the Supreme Court for why this sort of provision that places ministers on equal footing with hundreds of thousands of secular workers is perfectly constitutional. So I'd say bring it on.
Luke, great news for us. Luke Goodrich has been my guest. He is vice president of the Beckett Fund and senior counsel in this particular case. You are listening to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry of FRC Action. Coming up next, we will have Joel Rosenberg, New York Times best-selling author of 14 novels and 5 nonfiction books, who has just released his latest political thriller novel. And if the topic sounds a little too close to home, you will realize why very shortly. His thriller entitled The Persian Gamble is a terrifying nuclear alliance story among three world powers, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, and the one man who must halt their deadly strategy. We'll be talking with Joel Rosenberg right after this.
Myth and folklore have influenced our civilization for centuries. Some of these myths can be wondrous tales of fantasy that inspire us from childhood, such as unicorns and the ever-beloved elf on a shelf. Others, however, can be detrimental to our well-being, from the Loch Ness Monster to big tax refunds. Today, the myths surrounding abortion have become part of such vexations that plague our society. Since 1973, these abortion myths have grown a substantial foothold in developing a climate of fear, misinformation, and a culture of death in the United States. In FRC's new analysis, learn whether most Americans support abortion on demand, and if a fetus does in fact feel pain in the womb. Join us as we debunk these myths and find the truth to secure a future for the culture of life. Visit frc.org/myths.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for FRC Action, sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Well, you've probably heard the name before because you've probably read one of his 19 books. Joel Rosenberg is a New York Times best-selling author and a graduate of Syracuse University with a BFA in filmmaking. He is married, lives with his family in Israel. And on March 12th, he released The Persian Gamble, which is his newest book, a fact-based novel to praise from leaders for its eerily realistic plot. Joel, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, Sarah. Great to be with you.
Well, Joel, I will say this, and I am jealous because I have dabbled in writing myself, but you have been described as having a unique gift, not only for your ability to craft elegant prose, but in some respects to, shall we say, predict the future. In fact, I'm going to read a quote here from Rush Limbaugh. He has said that Joel Rosenberg has become one of the greatest thriller mystery novelists in the country, as well as becoming an expert on American Middle Eastern policy. It's like he has a supernatural insight into what will happen with American and Middle Eastern foreign and nuclear policy. Do you feel as if you have the finger on the pulse? Because I think the rest of us are in awe of how close this comes.
Well, I love Rush, and I was deeply, deeply touched by that and moved by that endorsement this week. I will say this, Sarah. I am not trying to predict things. I am trying to write political thrillers like The Persian Gamble that are worst-case scenarios that imagine what could happen if American and Western leaders are blindsided by evil we don't understand. It's not that I'm saying that these things will happen. I'm saying these things could happen. And so that's the, you know, and U.S. News and World Report has called me a modern Nostradamus. You know, I do shy away from those things that I'm doing something predictive. That's not really true, although it has felt true because sometimes the novels have seemed eerily close to what has actually ended up happening.
So let me ask you this question. Why the use of fiction as a vehicle to ask this what if type of question, as opposed to taking another format in which you have worked, which is to say nonfiction? We know North Korea, Iran, the United States, these are major political power players. These are ongoing discussions. You can turn on the news at night. Why not go the nonfiction route? Why the use of fiction here to address this question?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I would I've basically two answers. One is I did try that route. I spent 10 years in Washington. I was essentially, and for all intents and purposes, a failed political consultant. Every candidate I ever worked for lost. If they did well, it was years after I was involved with them. So that was number one. I tried that route. Secondly, I would say that, 2 weeks ago, I was invited into the Oval Office. It was my first meeting with President Trump. It was also happened to be a meeting with Vice President Pence, Secretary of State Pompeo, and National Security Advisor John Bolton. In that meeting, the president asked me, all right, give me the summary of the Persian gamble. Mm-hmm. So this is what I told him. I said, Mr. President, imagine what if the Iranian regime took the $150 billion that President Obama gave to the Iranian regime for agreeing to the insane Iran nuclear deal. And what if the Iranians took that money and went to North Korea and tried to buy these nuclear warheads off the shelf? And he said, how do you know they're not already trying to do that? Mm. And I said, well, Mr. President, I'm trusting that you and everyone in this room is working every day to make sure that the Persian gamble never comes true. Now, the reason I say that to you is because I don't think I would have gotten invited in if I'd written an op-ed or a nonfiction book. There's something about fiction that captures people's imagination in an entertainment-based culture that we have in the United States. Right or wrong, it just is it's just where we are. Some people are going to get their information and be interested in ideas because of film, television, and novels, not because the president said it or they read it in the newspaper on the op-ed page. So this is a way of capturing people's imagination and taking them on a high-speed, high-thrill ride, but also teaching, warning, inspiring, challenging the American people and their leaders.
I will say the book itself is perfectly ripe for cinematic adaptation. Do you have any desires to see this made into a movie?
Well, absolutely. Tipped off people that I did actually go to film school. That was what I studied at Syracuse University. And, we've been approached from time to time over the last 17 years of writing these thrillers, and no deal finally seems to work together with a major studio. We have interest in one right now I can't speak about until it actually moves forward. But, yeah, I would love to see one of these things happen. It hasn't happened yet, but we'd still love to see that work.
The book is The Persian Gamble. It is available, I am assuming, everywhere books are sold. Go out, pick up the book. Joel is a very gifted writer. You are listening to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry sitting in. Coming up next, we will talk about both a drag queen story hour and the decision to make all female soccer players wear a rainbow flag on their uniforms, despite what the FIFA regulations have to say. You're listening to Washington Watch. We'll be right back.
Picture it. Majestic beauty all around you. Wildlife, deep blue waters, glacial mountains, lush forests. Can you imagine the majesty of creation at every turn? Discover Alaska with FRC. You'll enjoy every moment of this unforgettable experience. Juno, accessible only by sea and air. Ketchikan and its impressive collection of Native American totem poles. Glacier Bay, a breathtaking wonder. All this, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what Family Research Council is doing in our nation's capital. You'll hear directly from FRC President Tony Perkins, General Jerry Boykin, and Michelle Bachmann. This is no ordinary vacation. You'll be vacationing with the FRC family and a lot of new friends. Be rejuvenated as we deepen our relationships with God and each other. Don't just get away. Get away with purpose on Family Research Council's Alaska Cruise, July 7th through 14th. Call 844-872-5155 to register today or visit us online at frc.org/Alaska.
In recent news, we've seen the left's disregard for life. They've gone beyond defending abortion to now defending infanticide. We've seen the push for legislation in New York, Vermont, and Virginia that would allow abortion even on a baby's birthday. And if an abortion fails, to withhold medical care from the baby born alive, causing him or her to die. This is infanticide. In the left's most recent act of disregard toward human life, we saw each Democratic senator running for president vote against a bill that would protect babies born alive. Help us end birthday abortion. On the day of a baby's birth, the first article placed on the baby is a thermal hat with blue and pink stripes. That's our hope for every baby. But there are no federal laws in place to protect all babies born alive from being killed outside the womb. To show your support for the life of all babies born alive, visit endbirthdayabortion.com. For a donation of $9, we'll deliver one baby hat on your behalf to U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to send a powerful reminder that babies should be welcomed with warmth.
Myth and folklore have influenced our civilization for centuries. Some of these myths can be wondrous tales of fantasy, from unicorns to the ever-beloved elf on a shelf. Others, however, can be detrimental to our well-being. Today, the myths surrounding abortion have become part of such vexations that plague our society. In FRC's analysis, 10 Myths on Abortion, join us as we debunk these myths and find the truth to secure a future for the culture of life. Visit frc.org/myths.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to our other free resources, go to frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for FRC Action, sitting in for Tony. In my final segment, we'll touch on a hot-button issue that has been a source of repeated discussion here at FRC because we hear about this quite a bit in the news cycle. First, Drag Queen Story Hour and why there are individuals coming in to public libraries, publicly funded libraries, reading to captive audiences of children's in full drag, but we'll also talk about why the LGBT rainbow flag should not appear on soccer uniforms of professional soccer players. So I'm going to start first with the Drag Queen Story Hour. Recently in the news, we discovered that a Storytime reader in Houston was once charged with a child sex assault. It is a nationwide program, this Drag Queen Story Hour phenomenon, and has arisen specifically within the past year and has drawn both supporters and opponents. And there has been an increasing normalization of men who are in drag, who are wearing makeup. This is part of an overall push by a left-wing agenda to deconstruct the notion of biological femininity. And so these are men who come to public libraries to read to audiences of children. But here's how the proponents of the Drag Queen Story Hour describe the phenomenon itself. From the website, Drag Queen Story Hour captures the imagination and play of the gender fluidity of childhood and gives kids glamorous, positive, and unabashedly queer role models. In spaces like this, kids can see people who defy rigid gender restrictions and imagine a world where people can present as they wish and where dress-up is real. Needless to say, for my part, I believe this is a psychological abuse of the captive audiences in which these men are performing. So I am joined now to discuss this by Katie Cross, who was with the Louisiana Family Forum. She battled a Drag Queen Story Hour in her hometown of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And she joins us today. Christy, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Christy, you and I have talked about this a little bit offline, and so I understand specifically what took place in your situation down in Lafayette, Louisiana. And the listeners may be thinking to themselves, well, Lafayette, Louisiana Sounds like an incredibly conservative parish. How does a circumstance like a drag queen story hour develop in such an area?
We were able to kind of trace back the roots of this event, and we think that it started like many of the problems that we're having in local areas with the American Library Association, the national association that came and had their convention down here in Louisiana, and the topic was discussed, and the local library staff, the director of the library, and then a fraternity at the local college, you know, they thought what a great idea it would be. So they started almost partnering and working together for the library to sponsor and promote and help plan this event. And it became public when it was published in the library newsletter as a library event that was going to be held, you know, for 3 to 6 year olds at the main library's story castle in the children's room at the library, not a private room that, you know, that can be reserved for events. This was going to be a library event.
So let me ask you a question specifically about the mayor of Lafayette. When he entered the political fray, what did he have to say about this particular circumstance?
He questioned, you know, rightfully so, questioned the wisdom of whether, you know, that was the proper role for the library using taxpayer money, you know, and of course the library gets all of its funds from the parish, from the taxpayers, that maybe that wasn't the best use of those tax dollars. The library director disagreed. The library board of control disagreed. They brought it to the city council, the city parish council in Lafayette, and the councilmen that sponsored the resolution weren't trying to make the library cancel the event. They simply wanted to express the opposition of the council in having the event, and that failed. That meeting, though, that night really showed, though, what happens when people get activated and involved on a local level. The council meeting was packed. There were so many people. The churches got together, you know, across denominational lines, across, you know, just across the whole area. People got together and they came to that meeting. And many of them apologized to their city councilman and said, you know, we're sorry that this is the first time we've been to this meeting or to this council chamber. We need to be more involved. And eventually, you know, to fast forward a little bit, eventually the event was canceled. They were going to move it from the library to a local community college. He then said, and that was for space concerns, the community college said, no, you know, we have security concerns, which we have a lot of doubt as to, you know, the credibility of that claim.
Sure.
But nonetheless, they canceled it there. And eventually, you know, a couple more steps down the line, the Drag Queen Story Hour did take place in the Lafayette Library in a private room that was reserved by the private individuals that were going to host the event. It was not hosted, sponsored, publicized, or anything by the library.
And well, that sure and so is a heck of a fight for that's a heck of a fight for one discrete event. I'm sure you probably did not anticipate having to make such a coordinated response effort to something like Drag Queen Story Hour. Were you surprised that it was moved after that much effort, or were you really sort of encouraged by the fact that they seemed to be responsive to what your concerns were despite the protestations of intolerance?
Well, there was still quite a bit of pushback, and I work as general counsel for Louisiana Family Forum, which is the family policy council here in Louisiana, and in coordination with our, you know, sister organizations around the country, we, you know, kind of keep up with one another of what's going on, and we have found out that many other states are having to, you know, come up against this same type of situation where they want to have 3 to 6 year old kids and the library involvement. Of course, you know, under the Constitution, there's the argument that you can't do anything if, you know, in a private business or a private individual and, you know, you have to give them the access, you know, and that's kind of another argument altogether. What we were talking about here was the state sponsored, the library sponsored with the taxpayer money of this type of event, and just the political agenda that was behind it. You know, I question whether or not it really is about teaching acceptance to kids. There are plenty of ways that you can teach love and kindness and respect to 3 to 6-year-old children that don't involve putting them in this type of inappropriate situation.
Christy Cross from Louisiana Family Forum has been my guest for this first segment. Christy, thank you. Congratulations on your success down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I'm going to shift gears for a minute. We're going to talk about the definition of a woman in sports and the definition of a woman overall, but specifically how it impacts professional sports. I am joined now by Dr. Jennifer Bryson. She is the founder of LetAllPlay.org and a commentator regularly on the intersection of sports, politics, and religion. Dr. Bryson, welcome.
Thank you.
So before we talk about the specific situation with FIFA, can you tell us what that acronym stands for those who are not sort of well-versed specifically in the nature of soccer? We are a football family. We do not follow soccer very closely. So can you talk about what it stands for and the organizing body that manages what uniforms should look like and can demonstrate?
So FIFA is actually an acronym from a long French name. But the key thing is that it's the International Soccer Association, or the International Association of Soccer Associations. And there's two governing bodies. FIFA governs soccer over the whole world, and a second organization called the IFAB, the International, we'll go into that. They make the rules, and FIFA recognizes the IFAB rules. But FIFA is essential for soccer at all levels, international, professional, and amateur.
Okay. So in this particular circumstance, the Diversity Week for the international governing body of the sport of soccer was sort of in conjunction with these rainbow LGBT flags appearing on women's soccer uniforms. Now, I know, because I have read ahead on this, that there is actually a governing regulation that dictates what can and cannot appear on soccer uniforms. So can you tell us a little bit about what happened here?
Sure. So this has been happening. The LGBT rainbow is being used on soccer uniforms at the international, professional, and amateur level. And where it first came to my attention was that the United States national teams in 2017 during Pride Month in June required that the men and women wear the LGBT rainbow on their uniform. In 2018, both the United States and the Federal Republic of Ireland required players to wear it. England has required their women to wear it. And most recently, just starting last week, a team in Germany at the professional level in the Bundesliga is requiring all players to wear a special LGBT rainbow on the uniform.
So what is a team to do if they decide they're not going to wear a uniform appropriated with what is obviously a political symbol? Do they have any recourse?
So the first recourse is that this violates the rules of soccer. According to the international laws of the game, it says equipment must not have any political, religious, or personal slogans, statements, or images. So this violates that rule because the LGBT rainbow is a political symbol. Secondly, for individual players who choose not to wear it, I believe it violates their religious freedom. And I see it as coerced speech. And I know of two cases of players refusing to wear it.
And what has been the response to those two players who have decided they're not going to wear it? I'm hesitant to guess that it probably has not been a favorable outcome.
It has hurt both of their careers, and both have been harassed on social media. One is the American player, Jalene Hinkle, who has in the past played for our women's national team, who's professional. And the second is a professional player from Croatia who plays in the Bundesliga in Germany and plays for the national team in Croatia.
And have they suffered a disadvantage outside of being sort of treated differently than their peers? Are these individuals that have to be afraid for their professional soccer careers?
Yes. Jaylene Hinkle has been harassed. There was an organized harassment campaign against her when her professional team played in Portland. There were signs mocking her. She was booed when she touched the ball. And then about a month later, when she was called up again to the national team because she's a top player in the world, within 24 hours, the team let her go. And it appears that it was because during those 24 hours, the LGBT lobby was outraged that they would allow her to play. Whereas I think soccer and other sports should be for everybody. It should be a shared space for everybody, regardless of your politics.
So you talked a little bit about forced speech, about the compelled notion of wearing a symbol or a designation with which one might not agree. And the IFAB rules seem to protect that particular designation by saying nothing political, nothing religious, nothing that would deem to be an endorsement of a particular way of thinking or an ideology of sorts. So when there are criticisms of the fact that this runs afoul to IFAB's own structure, its own regulations and dictations, what do they have to say?
Well, I have never seen anybody raise the rules violation specifically. And so I spent 7.5 months writing a report that was just released publicly that's called Let All Play, Yes to Soccer, No to Politics, in which I detail the rules violation. And with this, I want to raise the issue to IFAB, and I also want to equip players and soccer team staff who are uncomfortable with this to know what their rights are and what the rules are.
So you referenced your report. I have a copy of it here, and it was Let All Play. So was there a particular finding for this report that you felt was more surprising than any other?
One of the things that surprised me is I went through many, many, many FIFA documents over months. And it was not the case that I was just pulling out the violations and ignoring other things. Every time I went through another document, the ethics code, the details for uniforms, and on, I kept finding violation after violation after violation. Mm. For example, the number on the back should only be a certain number of colors. The captain armband should not have more than two colors. Putting the rainbow on all of these is also a technical violation. And also, the FIFA ethics code considers the player's conscience, and there should not be coercion of conscience. Mm. And so I think that's important when a player says, this wearing this that I disagree with would violate my conscience.
Where can listeners get a copy of your report?
It's at letallplay.org.
Thank you so much. Dr. Bryson has been my guest today. Too short. We have lots of other things that I know we wish we could have talked about today. But for those of you who are listening, please go to TonyPerkins.com. You will find information about our podcast, more information about our guests, and we encourage you to share from that link. Also, feel free to follow Tony at T Perkins. You can follow me as well on Twitter at Sarah P. Perry. We'll have lots more exciting stories this week on Washington Watch, though Congress is out and in their home districts. More to come tomorrow on Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. Thanks for joining us.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.